Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Monday, October 17th, 2016. Please follow us on Facebook at Commentary. Like us at Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Commentary. I'm John Podhoritz, the editor of Commentary. You can follow me on Twitter at JPodhoritz. Noah C. Rothman, at Noah C. Rothman. Noah Rothman, our assistant online editor, sitting to my right. And Abe Greenwald, at Abe Greenwald, our senior editor, sitting to my left. And the story of the morning is the continuing pull away from the Hillary Clinton's pulling away from Donald Trump in poll after poll after poll nationally and at the state level, right?
Oh yeah. With the exception of an ABC Washington Post survey that was released this weekend, which showed bizarrely that the gender gap closing in this contest after a week in which Donald Trump had been accused by no fewer of 15 women of groping and general sexual assault. That didn't make a whole lot of sense. But nevertheless, the likely voter model in that poll showed Hillary Clinton up by 4, 43-47, followed closely on by an NBC News Washington Post, NBC News Wall Street Journal poll, which showed Hillary Clinton with an 11-point lead over Donald Trump in a four-way race with a gigantic gender gap, much more aligned with what you would think would happen, 10 points in the head-to-head, so she's winning handily in the national level. And on the state level, we're starting to see some signs that the bottom is falling out. There's polls in places like Arizona, Georgia, Utah, and Alaska, which suggests that the race is at least competitive.
In those states. Which should be firmly in the Republican camp, so much so that Democrats shouldn't even be spending money there in
but
a
they
conventional
are.
Year.
Hillary Clinton's campaign just announced they're putting some money into Arizona, they're putting money into Indiana and Missouri, they're sending a lot of surrogates over to Arizona in the coming weeks. This is more than just a feint. These are actual plays for these states, which we were privy to news reports that suggested the campaign was sort of agonized over whether or not to make a real play for these expanded map states, and it looks like they're not agonized anymore. And now we had an NBC News post, which if you're reading, you should go find it because the quotes are amazing. It's a lot of Republicans from that state, former Jan Brewer people, members of the state party, saying that the Trump campaign is not treating this like a swing state, and it is. There's not enough resources to hold this state. It's going to go blue unless Donald Trump puts money into it.
Well, you know, if Trump wins Georgia and Arizona and Alaska and loses Utah, that is not the extent of the surprises that we will see on election night. That's what we know. That means he'll lose Indiana. It means he's certainly gone in North Carolina, and it certainly means Ohio is gone. So basically, the election's over under those conditions. If he loses North Carolina, the election is over. There's no map with him winning that barely features, you know, in which he doesn't have to win North Carolina. Like
Pennsylvania. If he were to win Pennsylvania, yeah, that's the key to
12,
the universe.
Yeah, but he's 12 points down in Pennsylvania. Sure. So he's not going to win Pennsylvania. But, you know, North Carolina is, you know, a 3 or 4 point race. But the whole point here is whether we're going to have a sort of conventionally large Democratic victory in these scenarios of the sort that Obama won. He won 365 electoral votes in 2008. He won 332 in 2012. She well may be on track to besting him in the Electoral College if all of these signs appear to... Remember, Obama then, you know, Obama in 2008 flipped North Carolina, Virginia, and Indiana. Indiana was the big surprise there. Virginia is now, it appears, now a blue state as a Democratic state presidentially, which is an enormous loss for the GOP, by the way. And again, North Carolina is a swing state because it swung back to Romney in 2012. But I mean, it's impossible to imagine a sort of a psychological scenario in which Trump loses Arizona but wins North Carolina, even though they're not really related, they don't have much to do with each other. And then there are weird things like Nevada, which was supposed to be something that a state that he could contest in is now, I think, out of the margin of error, 6 or 7 points.
That was always predicated on the idea that Obama was not especially well-loved there, and there has a lot of a big population without degrees. But it's kind of hard to emphasize how much Democratic turnout is usually overcomes that in a state because, like Arizona, because it's so unionized and so organized.
Right. So basically what we have here is a question of a presumed Clinton victory, and now the question is what margins we're talking about.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary luxury for her, actually, to sort of now consider what kind of victory she wants to fashion out of this.
Right, or could seek. Right, you know, it's funny because they're right to be nervous about devoting too many resources to some of these possible states. You know, one of the great political errors in modern times came when George W. Bush got overconfident in the last 2 weeks in 2000 and started making a play for California when he should have been spending all his money in Florida, not knowing that there was going to be this late hit in the week before the election of that he had had a drunk driving. Imagine this, ladies and gentlemen. That the thing that lost George Bush apparently 3 million evangelical votes in 2000 was that he had a drunk driving arrest in 1976. I just want to point that out because now we have evangelical leaders who are supporting Donald Trump.
Trump doesn't drink, so, you know, they're consistent.
Yeah, Trump doesn't drink and he gropes, and obviously Jimmy Swaggart groped, so I guess maybe there's precedent there, But again, you know, it's like all the famous hits of late hits of our time. You know, that one, the drunk driving arrest, or you know, Marco Rubio's boat, Mitt Romney's dog on the roof. You know, it's by the way, also let's take a moment to feel nauseated at the crocodile tears being wept by liberals and Democrats over how wonderful and good a person Romney was and how much they would appreciate having him now. Wasn't Binders full of women? In retrospect, that was kind of quaint when Romney said, you know, he was so interested in having women staff his administration that he had Binders full of women. Well, it was quaint then, too. It was entirely innocuous, and everybody made a big deal of it, and because you made a big deal of it, you helped create Trump. So don't you be crying in your beer about, you know, this picture fashioned of this horrendous, unjust picture fashioned of Mitt Romney that certainly had some resonance in 2016. So every time Trump does something, there's an id inside the Republican Party and the conservative movement that says, look, they'll say anything about us anyway, so who cares what it is? At least Trump's a fighter, you know, because if they'll say Mitt Romney, who gave $15 million a year away to charity and, you know, paid $30 million a year in taxes and closed down his company so that for a week, so that everybody could help find a 15-year-old missing girl who had, you know, wandered off from her family into New York City and, you know, had this wonderful family and, you know, just incredibly upright life. And there they are digging up some event from when he was 14 in boarding school and some family joke about how he put the dog on the roof and trashing his character.
And savaging Mormonism.
Mormonism, that's right. Well,
It should be noted, actually, that this isn't just the press either. This was the Obama campaign and its members. You have Stephanie Cutter out there and Ben LeBolt, who are also talking to the press about what a wonderful man this was. Steph Cutter held a conference call in which she had that widower of one of properties that was shut down and reorganized by Bain Capital, which turned it into a priorities ad that accused Mitt Romney of being complicit in a negligent homicide. And Ben LeBolt also accused Mitt Romney of felony FEC violations. And, of course, Harry Reid, without evidence, suggested that Mitt Romney had paid zero in taxes. Now we have somebody who probably did pay zero in taxes for 20 years, and nobody's listening.
Right. So here we are.
And, you know, in 2020, when whoever the Republican nominee is then, I'm sure he'll be you know, objectively saintly compared to Trump, but right, will still be.
But it will be interesting because it will be very hard for anybody to be worse than Trump. And under those circumstances, what are they going to do? It's a little bit of a get out of jail free card. Mm. It's like, oh, really? So the worst thing that I ever did was, you know, take a trip with somebody? Really? Well, you know, the last Republican nominee did X, and B, the president, the now president of the United States, Hillary Clinton, had a guy at the State Department, as we have now discovered through releases of emails this morning, a guy at the State Department, 2 years after she left the State Department, desperately attempting to make deals with the FBI so that emails, classified emails, could be buried so she couldn't be accused of having mishandled classified information, which is an interesting story. The story about Kennedy, the Undersecretary of State for Management at the State Department, because it would appear that Kennedy and others had determined that Hillary Clinton had committed a crime and that the crime had to be hidden, and then 16 months later, of course, James Comey comes out and says, well, there was no crime. I mean, no one could be prosecuted for this. They looked at this. They looked at the totality of what had happened after the news broke of the homebrew server and what was going on the homebrew server, and they knew immediately that Hillary was in legal jeopardy, and they sought proactively to crush and bury the information that suggested that it was. And what's most interesting about this, what's most horrifying about this when you think about it, is that Hillary had not been Secretary of State for more than 2 years. She was just a not yet entirely quite declared candidate for president, or maybe she was a just declared candidate for president. I can't remember which. She was not the only declared candidate for president. The State Department machine apparatus goes into defend Hillary Clinton mode. She is not the Secretary of State. She does not work for the Obama administration. She is one of a potential 7 or 8 different candidates who's going to run for office. What the hell was going on there? How deep was this effort to protect Hillary Clinton from the consequences of her actions? How high up the chain did it go? Was Kennedy acting on his own behalf? Did his boss, John Kerry, know that he was negotiating with the Justice Department and the FBI on reclassifying emails? Totally disingenuously, by the way, since according to Steve Hayes' reporting in the Weekly Standard, we don't know what the email was that he wanted reclassified, but he wanted an email reclassified as geological information, because then he could bury it in, according to an interview with the FBI that Steve Hayes did, he could then bury the email in the basement of the State Department for it never to be seen again. We don't know what email that is. I mean, maybe it's one of the ones that had the C on it that Trump likes to make fun of during the debates. But I mean, just for the sake of argument, in 2020, any effort to impugn the character of whoever runs against President Clinton is going to run into a buzz. And having had Trump as the candidate in 2016 is going to run into an expectations buzzsaw.
I predict,
in my view,
I agree, but they'll make grand efforts to overcome that somehow.
We know how they do this. They run the same playbook every year. Whoever runs against them will have suspicious sentiments about women in their hearts. We don't want to, you know, make accusations, but it is very conspicuous that somebody would dare run against the first female president of the United States.
Well, that's the big question, of course, is Hillary Clinton becomes president. She moves into the White House. We know her pattern of behavior. We know her husband's pattern of behavior. She's 60. She'll be 69 years old. She's not going to change. She will have managed, by the way, to get elected in a hearty way to the White House, despite all of these, you know, things that would have destroyed other candidates, you know, wholesale. What lesson is she going to draw from this? That she shouldn't continue on the way she's continued on? That's not the lesson I would draw. I'm not going to turn into, you know, Caesar's husband, Caesar's wife, whatever you want, you know, turn into a purity person. you know, being playing it fast and loose got her everything she wanted, got her fortune, got her Secretary of Stateship, got her foundation, got her the $200 million she and her husband wanted, got her into the White House, got her control of everything. She doesn't have to change her playbook.
And look at all the dragons she can claim to have slayed this year. The Benghazi and the homebrew server scandals and Donald Trump coming up against her. I mean, this is, you know, she's...
And a revolt on the far left.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, and Bernie Sanders. Yeah. I mean,
so the real question is, a candidate who gets through this and manages it, does she say to herself, I am bulletproof and I will go on and do things the way they do them? Or is she really bulletproof? I mean, the problem is that without the dynamic... Here was the dynamic. The dynamic is Trump rises in the GOP, right? And it's clear that he's a serious possibility for the presidency in the late fall of 2015, even though everyone's saying, no, it's not really going to... You know, he's winning at the... We're all like, no, it can't happen, possibly, but he's 20 points up on everybody else in the polls. And it's a real possibility. And meanwhile, she's got this 74-year-old socialist basically as her only rival. And it starts not going so well for her. I mean, you know, he's hitting her in the right way, and he's going after her on Goldman Sachs and all of that. And she, you know, basically loses 44% of the Democratic primary vote, is secured by the existence of the superdelegate system, which was put into place to make sure that Bernie Sanders's couldn't win the nomination. And then, of course, her instant mission is not only to defeat Sanders, but is to save the country from Donald Trump. Well, what happens when there's no Donald Trump to save the country from anymore? What happens when, what happens when the person you have to save the country from is Paul Ryan? And what does Paul Ryan want to do? He wants to reorganize Medicare so that the country doesn't go broke in 2028. He's got this Boy Scout Better Way set of proposals, which are not exactly draconian, despite what Democrats might say about it. Can she turn Paul Ryan into Newt Gingrich? I sort of doubt it. And does she have the skill to turn Paul Ryan? You didn't take any skill to turn Donald Trump into the boogeyman. He is the boogeyman. The skill of Bill Clinton was to turn people who were not really boogeymen into boogeymen and to take them, demonize them, and then turn them into punching bags. I mean, because of their own weaknesses, like Newt Gingrich and others. Will Hillary Clinton have the skill to create the opposition, as Obama did to some extent, to create the opposition that she wants to run against, to ballast her own side and to get her way? That skill I do not believe she possesses.
Well, a lot of this depends on the makeup of the next Congress, right? And that's kind of been the sub rosa storyline of the last week, is that the bottom's falling out for Donald Trump, but the floor is not buckling under Republican incumbents, to the point where we have a couple of polls now that show the generic congressional ballot is kind of tightening, actually, from where it was a week or two ago. And then we had the spectacular poll result, which none of us in this room really want to believe because it's too great, from NBC News Wall Street Journal, that suggests that to the tune of 53% to 40%, voters are prepared to vote for Republican candidates in order to check the inevitable 45th president of the United States, Hillary Clinton.
Remember, that is all voters.
Yeah,
that poll number is all voters. That is not Republican voters. That is not Republicans and independents. That is Republicans, independents, and Democrats. Altogether, the national number is by a 13-point margin, Americans want a check on presidential power in the form of Congress in the hands of another party. This is an astonishing number, as Noah says. Hard to believe that it's that true, but it does suggest that the public is more cognizant of what it will mean for them to vote in somebody that 60% of them view unfavorably.
Yeah, you know, and this sort of is of a piece with a lot of stuff I've seen on social media from liberals who aren't even particularly political or involved in politics. But I've seen a lot of having gone from I'm with her sort of stuff to, can't we just get past this? This is a terrible choice. I mean, in some sense, I feel like the nonstop scandals have had an effect. The effect hasn't been to knock her out of the running, but it has been to to bring down the enthusiasm.
This is so unquestionable that you have to think about the difference between criticizing Barack Obama in 08 or even in 12 when there was a lack of enthusiasm for Barack Obama among Democrats. That was one of the reasons that the Romneyites thought that they were going to win on Election Day, and the withdrawal of enthusiasm from Hillary Clinton. I mean, I would say the number of people who say things like, you don't like her because you're a misogynist, or I'm with her and how dare you, is really quite small and includes toadies like Peter Beinart, who is, you know, sucking up for a job or who knows sucking up for what just so he can get good invitations to the Hanukkah party at the White, so he and his kids can light the menorah at the Hanukkah party or something like that. But it is not an argument that seems to have gotten the kind of purchase that one might have thought particularly in a year when we're talking about and Trump's misogyny and all of that, because the email scandals are so serious and because it yet again points out that the major political error of 2015 and 2016, the error that paid immense dividends from Hillary Clinton, totally unforced, was Bernie Sanders saying in that debate, we're sick and tired of hearing about your damn emails. That idiot, that fool, imagine that he was prosecuting two cases against Hillary simultaneously, right? One, that she was a tool of the banks and corporate special interests, and the other, that she had threatened national security with the handling of her emails. He didn't do it because the whole point was that the Clinton campaign and Democrats successfully tried to make it as though the only people who cared about this subject were crazy partisan Republicans, and he lost his insurgent bid for the presidency because he was a wimp and a wuss, and he hated Republicans more than he loved his own chances, and he didn't understand, and he couldn't talk about national security. Imagine Hillary against Biden. You think Biden wouldn't have eaten her lunch on the server? I mean, she would have had to withdraw before the fifth primary. He's like, look, I've done a lot of things in my life, and I've been in the Senate, and I've been in this, and I've worked for this administration. You know, Hillary, I really don't appreciate how you put our national security at risk in this administration. Say goodbye. Say goodbye. But because people aren't even following the story. Look, we follow the story granularly. People don't follow the story that closely, but they know she did something bad. They know she did something bad and that her excuses are bad, and that every time she starts talking about it in debates and things, she issues that bizarre little laugh that says, I'm about to lie to you and try to prevaricate to see if I can just get through 3 minutes without saying something that will, you know, cause me to have perjured myself, opened me up to a perjury indictment. Or something like that. I mean, you know that she's full of it.
But this is why the makeup of the next Congress matters so much, is that she's not good at covering her butt, and she's paranoid and conspiratorial and insular, and she'll make sure that she behaves the exact same way as she behaved at state. But she could face one or two Republican majorities. The prospects now is that we have, for three consecutive cycles, Americans have voted for divided government. They're going to again in a fourth. We just don't know how much the margin is going to be, and it could very well possibly be that the Senate majority for Republicans survives. That would be a tough ask, but the House majority is almost certainly safe. Now, and one of Republicans' agendas is check on the presidential powers under Paul Ryan's Better Way agenda. That's a very explicit item in his agenda.
Right. Now, it is not beyond the bounds of probability that all of this idea that the bottom has not fallen out for Republicans is a species of the current moment.
Right.
We have another debate on Wednesday.
There's it defies lot, history for that to actually happen.
There's got to be another hit or two. You don't release your late hits at the beginning of October if you don't have more for the end of October. We don't know what those are. We don't know what material they were gathering against him, and
Republican enthusiasm is down.
Right, it is still possible that there will be a punch to the solar plexus that will, in combination with the punch to the solar plexus last week, will leave Republicans literally without air, folded over in the corner, just trying to, not have to go to the emergency room. And, if they have to go to the emergency room, they'll be in the emergency room, won't vote on November 8th. So right now, the news is better for the GOP's future with a Hillary Clinton presidency, but we cannot be assured that it won't get worse. Now, the only question, I guess, then, and I'm going to now call on Abe Greenwald's imaginative powers, even though he doesn't know I'm going to ask him this, so he's going to freak out as I'm speaking. His heart is pounding. He's sweating. Could Trump do in the debate and over the next 3 weeks to halt his decline and somehow pull things back so that his loss, let's say, would be respectable?
Well, since this is an imaginative exercise.
That's what I said, okay. Imaginative.
Let's pretend that he could bone up starting now on policy and speak reasonably, yet forcefully, about the things that he has been speaking about up until now, but without making threats to jail his opponent and accusing her of flooding the country with ISIS-inspired refugees and whatnot. He won't do that.
He won't do that. But, you know, the funny thing is that right now there are two things that Chris Wallace will be bringing up on Wednesday night. Indisputably, like one will be the groping, and again, and he'll have to make account of that or whatever happens in the next 2 days before the debate as we're speaking. And the other is Chris Wallace will say, is it James Kennedy or Patrick Kennedy? Patrick Kennedy of the State Department was negotiating deals with the FBI to save to save you from possible indictment, Hillary Clinton. How do you respond to that? Trump, a controlled Trump, a calm Trump, who is up, who is boned up, and knows what the arguments are, and can talk about this comprehensively so that he doesn't get lost in the weeds, could corner her and, you know, could make it a very uncomfortable 20, 25, 30 minutes of the debate talking about this rationally. Not, you know, talking using this recent revelation and other revelations.
Yeah, because,
but that will not satisfy his, you know, World Wrestling Federation crowd, which wants him to throw a chair at her head.
But they wouldn't abandon him for it either.
No.
Yeah, I honestly don't know if that's unlikely to actually happen. I mean, in the last debate, that last hour was pretty competent from him. I mean, we're grading on a curve, but graded on a curve, he did like a B plus in that last hour, and
well,
it was
except for the you should be in jail line.
Right
now, so, you and I we didn't really defend him on the you should be in jail line, but it was sort of like it was a quip that followed thing. But you know, clearly,
method he was going to
pursue. Yeah, but clearly it was not a
he's gone a lot farther in the last couple of days on that.
Whatever it actually was, it was something that could be used in the media afterward
He got Hillary Clinton on the ropes on policy. And she's defending Barack Obama's record, she's in trouble because Barack Obama's record is A, terrible, B, unpopular. So if she gets cornered on her own stuff, she can't defend herself.
Absolutely.
She doesn't
and
look good.
And even when he does it inarticulately, right. He rattles her. She gets that goofy laugh before responding.
Yeah.
You know.
So that will frustrate Donald Trump's partisans who, like you say, want to see the WWE act. But you know, he could play for independent voters. Independent voters were at least at one point interested in hearing his message, and they weren't writing him off. Not very long ago, 4 weeks ago, he was competitive in this race. So right. Possible.
Look, the other way to look at it, I thought he won. I mean, I wrote a column in which I said I thought that he had trounced her in the second debate. But one of the marks that maybe the door had closed on him were these polls that showed her winning the debate. Now, why did the polls show her winning the debate? Because when you get into circumstances like this, it is rare for people to be able to say, well, it's sort of like being a follower of a team. I mean, it's rare to say, well, you know, the Dodgers really outplayed us that time. So every now and then it happens, right? Like Romney. Like, there's no one in the world who couldn't think that Romney hadn't shellacked Obama in the first debate in 2012. But when you get to a point where it's not entirely clear who won, the person who wins those debates is the person who has a more solid following, right? So in other words, if it's 48-42 or or, you know, 51-34, 51-35, something like that. That's a big mark of future voting patterns, in my view. In other words, you're saying, I've already picked her. Of course I'm going to say that she won. I like what she says. I don't like what he says. And if her numbers are bigger than his numbers, in the absence of a of an absolute rout where you have to say, well, that the other guy was better than my guy. Right. And so I think that was a mark of the Republican withdrawal from... Also, by the way, and because...
Women. A lot of those
and women.
Right. He was
and
so toxic going into that
right.
debate. That was
and,
right
and
after
also,
that.
Also, Republicans were watching it less. I mean, that's another mark of... Democrats were more excited to watch the debate because Republicans... And this is the subject of the editor's letter and commentary that we just put out online at commentarymagazine.com called The Truly Forgotten Republican Voter. Remember that like there is a substantial number of Republicans, as many as half of Republicans who are telling pollsters, 55% of Republican primary voters did not vote for Trump. Half of Republicans are telling pollsters they wish that there was somebody else running for president. There are people who do not want to watch this train wreck because it is their party and their movement and their cause that he is driving, you know, that he is literally driving off a cliff. It's a train wreck that drives off a cliff. So that's a bad mixed metaphor.
Right.
Well, it's the train, the trellis goes off the track and over the side of the mountain. How's that? That's a
well,
maybe
it's
a
like,
better
one. Kipling. They had to watch their words twisted by knaves
right.
To appeal to fools. But what's the exact wording?
Something I can't remember. But that's... Yes.
But that's so, exactly what they're going through.
So it's like, what do I need to watch this for? You know, and a lot of us on the right have noticed this, that really, and it was very much this way at the Republican convention in Cleveland, you know, that was a depressed convention. Those are Republican activists. This is not what they wanted to see. This is not the party... I mean, Republican activists who believe in limited government and, you know, a strong national defense and are American patriots and believe in free trade and, you know, the sort of what now is called, you know, like the establishment Republican orthodoxy, but is in fact a set of ideas that have undergirded, you know, the serious right for, you know, 40 or 50 years, if not longer. They're seeing those ideas taken and thrown into, you know, rolled up and thrown into the garbage can. A bunch of them may vote. A lot of them, if not all of them, may not all of them, but a lot of them will vote for Trump anyway because that is who they are, and they loathe Hillary, and they can't imagine ever voting Democratic, and they can't imagine not ever voting. But they don't have to sit and watch a debate in which he trashes their own ideas and says he's the Republican.
I just remember the quote, and it's actually more fitting. If you can stand to see your words twisted by knaves to set a trap for fools, and that's exactly
right.
What has happened.
Right.
Trump has set a trap, and he's not going to win.
So, but I'm just saying that, you know, in the end, when you see these numbers, which all help create the, you know, the storyline of a successful candidate. Hillary is likely to win the third debate, even if she loses the third debate, since I think she lost the second debate, but the poll said she won the second debate because there's a withdrawal of affect from Trump and withdrawal of Republican viewers from these events because mainstream Republicans are not happy with the way things are going.
So if the bottom falls out for everybody and history returns and Republicans down the ballot get shellacked along with the top of their ticket, which would be... what we should expect. We really shouldn't see the ticket splitting that a lot of people are indicating they want to do. Then Hillary Clinton gets to take no lessons from this, and she enters office a conspiratorial, paranoid person who will behave as she behaved as Secretary of State, only with the power of executive privilege. But if Republicans get to maintain a bit of a majority, like you say, they're going to have not only some legitimacy in being able to check Hillary Clinton, but also she's tainted. She's coming into this office completely scandal-plagued. And there are already investigations in the House committees into her behavior that are ongoing. New ones are popping up every day because there are new revelations about particularly her email, her conduct in these email scandals, but also involving the foundation. We have this new revelation regarding the potential that Bill Clinton was awarded a seven-figure birthday present from the government of Qatar that nobody can rule out whether or not it was just a gift. And there's possibly some expectations of remuneration in the form of favors from President Hillary Clinton in the future. And those are humongous deals that are going to paralyze her. She's
By the
going,
way,
not
that's
have
not,
a compliant
that story, the gutter story, the story about this $1 million gift is not just a whole pay for play, was this an effort to buy influence, but if it were a gift, if it was not properly allocated as a grant or a donation to the Clinton Foundation, but were personally a gift to him, and he signed it over to the foundation but did not report it on his income taxes, he is guilty of tax fraud. You cannot get a larger – the only monetary gift in the United States that does not have to be reported to the IRS is $11,000. $11,000 is what you were allowed to be given, and you are not allowed to – this is something – is an issue with the Trump Foundation and David Fahrenthold's amazing reporting on the Trump Foundation. You can't get a check and then endorse it over to somebody else if the check is in your name. You can send the check back, but you cannot therefore escape tax liability for it. That is not the way it works. Unfortunately, it might be nice if it were, you know, that you could just take your $100,000 thing and give it to somebody else so that you would have to make no note of it. So this is no joke. Now it's, you know, again, someone's going to have to prosecute it. The executive branch is in the hand, will be in the hands of the Clinton family. And
can I return your imagination there?
Yeah.
What, and this goes to either of you, what could Hillary do between now and the election to put her win in some sort of jeopardy? Or what could come out?
That's
the entire WikiLeaks release so far involves everything that is going on in her around her person, right? It's emails to John Podesta. It's emails from John Podesta. It's emails around John Podesta. It's all that stuff. The question is there stuff in there that where she is a respondent, she is an emailer, she says stuff, she says something like, bury this email scam. You know, she does the Nixon thing, you know.
I don't even think it has to be that blatant. What would come out, and this is what Republicans in media and actually in Congress are irresponsibly conflating both this DNC scandal and Hillary Clinton's email scandal. They're entirely distinct. If WikiLeaks were to drop one of Hillary Clinton's State Department emails that were obtained from her server having been hacked, as in it was obtained from Russian intelligence, that it doesn't even have to be a scandalous email. It could be a lunch order,
right,
but that would suggest that she's compromised.
And of course, her whole point is she said over and over again, there's no, you know, my emails were safe. No one's hacked them. But I'm not talking about that. We know that there is this giant WikiLeaks dump
but
and that
so
they have
far
all
it's
emails.
Just the DNC. It's just Democratic committees. It's not her server.
No, and John Podesta.
And Podesta.
And John Podesta's personal email. Well, what has not come out are emails between Podesta and Clinton, and maybe they're holding them, and there is something there like, you know, where she says, kill that puppy, you know, or, you know. But this is the horror show. The horror show of this election is something could come out like that that could make her look horrible and could make her look indictable and make her look as though, you know, she should be impeached if she's president, and that will not slow the train down because of the unacceptability of the choice. I mean, who's going to say, okay, I'm not, who that right now is telling pollsters they are going to vote for her is going to flip and vote for Trump or not vote? So much of the vote that we're reading about for her, some astonishing number, 70%, something like that, is an anti-Trump vote. That doesn't end if her unpopularity is already baked in the cake, right? So she is the second most unpopular person to run for president. She'll come into office unpopular or maybe marginally popular because people will decide they want to give her a shot or they want to think better of her because she's the new president, whatever. Something directly from her email or her mouth or something like that that really, really, really And something that threatened national security.
But if you were in possession of something like that, you would rather hold on to it at this point, I would think, for when she's inaugurated president.
Ah, but you're talking about leverage. The blackmail. So you're now talking about the issue of whether or not voting is ongoing.
I mean, right. This thing is baked. I mean, people have been voting for 2 weeks now in swing states.
Yeah. Well, that may be a more sophisticated understanding of how to manipulate the American political process than you might be getting from Julian Assange sitting, you know, in a dark room in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. I mean, I don't know what he knows or doesn't know about the makeup of the American extended voting system. All I'm saying is, playing Abe's imaginative game, she has to do something. She will have had to do something recklessly illegal and that also maybe, or something that reveals... What if something came out that somehow revealed that, you know, they leaned on Comey? I mean, something like right. that somebody close to her leaned on Comey. But again, I don't know that even that would be enough now. I mean, the margins here are very large. I mean, now it really is the case that, you know, if she's up by 7.5 in the Real Clear Politics average and we are now 3 weeks, tomorrow will mark 3 weeks until Election Day. There is no coming back from a margin like that. The only way you come back from a margin like that is that all the polling is an error. All of it is an error. That means that the hidden, missing, magical, missing Trump vote is simply not being recorded in the polls. And there are millions of people who are going to come out all over the country and all over the place to tilt this. It's almost impossible that that's the case. Remember the story, despite the fact that this is what Trumpians want to believe, the story of the primaries was not that the Trump vote was hidden. It was showing up in the polls, and Republican polls were saying in New Hampshire and other places, they didn't understand where these people were because they've been doing this for 30 years and they still didn't know a single person who was going to vote for Trump, and they didn't know where all these people were in New Hampshire that were going to vote for Trump, and they still voted for Trump anyway. The polls had it right. The political professionals had it wrong. Now, if the polls are right then and the polls are right now, he's toast. Those people were not invisible in the winter, and there's no reason that they should be invisible now whatsoever. Unless, you know, there's a hidden Trump vote. Now that he's gross and he's groped all these women, now people are going to say that they're not going to vote for him, but they will. But again, we're talking about these margins reach, if the election were held today, we're talking about a 10 million vote national margin in Hillary Clinton's favor. That's 10 million votes. Finding 10 million hidden votes, that's science fiction. One thing to say there were 2 or 3 million missing votes, which wasn't true about Romney in 2012. But it's one thing to say that in a nation of, you know, that 1% of the electorate somehow, you know, stayed home, or 1% of the country and 2.5% of the electorate stayed home because they were depressed and didn't like Romney, who would otherwise have voted Republican. But it's not the same to say 10 million people. That's preposterous, I think.
Nope, agreed.
Yeah, completely agreed.
Don't have anything to add to that one.
Right. So again, I want to pitch my own piece to you again, The Truly Forgotten Republican Voter at commentary, www.commentarymagazine.com. Take a look at it. It's a pretty provocative argument. It deals, you heard some of it actually on our last Tuesday's podcast. It was in chrysalis there. A lot of it having to do with Mary Beth Glenn, the Wisconsinite who did this amazing tweet storm about what Trump has done to her as a Republican.
Can I actually ask you to explore some of the themes in that? Because it's something I'm in the middle of writing right now, and I want to hear your reaction to. We're looking past the election now. The election's over, and we're all looking forward to what happens afterwards. And we've been talking in this podcast for a couple of days, consecutive weeks now, about what the Republican Party's future is going to look like. And there's a lot of people who are very invested in the idea that Donald Trump was a spectacularly terrible messenger for a message that needs a lot of redemption after the election. I think that's flawed. I have my own priors there that I'm invested in that. But in your piece, you note that We've spent a whole lot of time talking about the Trump voter who got 45% of whom voted for this guy. What about the other 55%?
Right. So the forgotten Trump voter is the major character, the forgotten American voter. It's the major character of 2016, the white working class depressed guy who, you know, the country is screwed and his income is stagnated. He doesn't have a job. He's on meth. He's on opiates. I mean, you sort of every possible cliche. He's playing video games instead of working. He's not getting married. He's living in his parents' basement. He's, you know, putting together some kind of a life. He's left the workforce. He's, you know, everything that you can possibly imagine. If we don't understand his pain, his trouble, his problems, you know, we're missing the truth about America. And one of the things I say in the piece is that far from being the forgotten American voter, this is the best known American voter that we've ever seen. This is the voter of 2016. This is the voter whose existence is so terrifying to mainstream Republicans that they are scared out of their wits to say anything negative about Donald Trump, lest the Trump voter rise in rage and and destroy his political future. Well, he is not the real forgotten voter. Once you start privileging one class of voters over the other, classically, you start. The question is, what discontinuities are there with everybody else? And of course, the problem with the Trump agenda is that it is so radically, maybe with the exception of immigration, it is so radically discontinuous with the general Republican agenda. And not just the Republican agenda, but the spirit of moral and spiritual Republicanism or conservatism in the United States. So the whole issue is, you're telling me that I have to vote for this sociopathic misogynist because Hillary Clinton is worse, number one, and number two, because I've been spending 30 years as a Republican woman defending Republicans against the charge that they hate women, that they're sexist, that they want to keep women pregnant, that they want to deny women control of their own bodies, that they, you know, that they have everything, that they think everything bad about women and minorities. And now you guys nominate this person who represents the caricature dream of every liberal's understanding of what a Republican is. And I'm supposed to go along with you? The hell with you. I'm not going along with you. I'm out of here. I'm wiping my hands of this. I'm ashamed to be anywhere in proximity to you. And I'm the one who manned your phone banks. I'm the one who went to your rallies. I'm the one who I'm the one who gave you money, even though I myself only make $75,000 a year. And you're turning me off in favor of somebody who never voted before? In theory, that the person who never voted before is more important than I am? Well, drop dead. And that is the story of 2016. That person, that angry person, who is now women, but not, forget women. I mean, what about us? What about people like us who have been standing around saying, no, I don't hate women. No, I don't. No, I may be pro-life, but I'm pro-life because I have a moral frame that undergirds my understanding of the way life is. It has nothing to do with, you know, women's rights. It's something else. It's a deep human right or deep spiritual thing. And you're telling me that this is what I am supposed to do. Well, I reject your premise. I mean, you know, day after day, all of us on Twitter, all of us who basically, a lot of us who say, look, I can't vote for her and I can't vote for him. So get these emails and text and things saying, you were effectively voting for her by not voting for him. And it's like, actually, logically, that is not true. It's a null set. If you're not a voter, you're not a voter. It's like an at-bat that doesn't count. Like, you're a null set. Well, so if you got a hit, then the hit would have been for, you know, but that presumes that in any case, I would only vote one way ever, which is not true about me anyway. But the point here is that there is this bizarre idea that there is moral superiority in saying, just come out and say what you think. You are implicitly supporting Hillary, so you're supporting Hillary. Or you are this, you are that. That's what I think. Whereas people are saying, I cannot vote for this man. He sickens me. He makes a mockery of everything I believe in. He will disgrace the country, and it will be a mark of the horror. And I've been writing this since the end of last year in the famous National Review against Trump issue, I said the problem with Trump wasn't policy, though I'm against him on policy. It's cultural. It's the meaning. He is America's id. He's the worst part of ourselves. And if he, if you know, it will be a cultural calamity if he wins. It will be a political and policy calamity if she wins. But it will not speak to some deep disease in the American psyche if she wins. It may speak to a deep disease in the American legal system and the American polity going forward in terms of policy. But these are two different things. And I'm not going to assent to her, you know, playing fast and loose with the law, and I'm not going to assent to him, his barbarism.
Well, this is the argument that's going to will result from that. You make the cultural argument, he's an offensive personality, and you can already see Republican reformers and people who are hardline immigration proponents contending the same thing for an agenda purpose. They want to preserve the idea that their agenda didn't lose at the polls by 10 million points, but by Donald Trump was just a really bad messenger. He was a sui generis. He was somebody who completely came out of nowhere and doesn't represent us. It's not our agenda that failed. It's Donald Trump's agenda that failed. Well, that strikes me as not entirely honest. We have a lot of data that shows Donald Trump's position on a Muslim ban, on the wall, on immigration deportation force. These things are unpalatable, not just to the general electorate, but to Republicans. We have agendas that suggest that the Republican Party, the notion that the Republican Party is a tax cuts only party, and that it has to be for the preservation of entitlements and even their expansion. This doesn't appeal to Republicans like it does to Republican reformers. And there's going to be a lot of efforts, in my opinion, to rehabilitate post hoc this guy after his loss as just sort of this ephemeral thing that came out of nowhere and didn't really have any agenda of sorts.
Yeah, I mean, I think almost the opposite is the truth. I mean, to the extent that he had appeal, it was the messenger that they liked.
Right.
Not the message.
Right. More important is, yes, that there is this line that's being, Ben Domenech of the Federalist said last week, Trump will lose and then nothing will change.
Yeah.
Because things need to change, but nothing will change. Well, what exactly is it that's supposed to change? I mean, again, we don't know what the margin is, but if he's at 40% and Hillary's at 51, or he's at 39 and Hillary's at 52, or something like that, let's just say, what part of his agenda wasn't rejected by the overwhelming majority of the American people? I mean, that's what happens. That is wilderness for a generation. Now, it doesn't mean that the Republican Party won't go down this path. McGovern lost by almost 24 points in 1972, and the party effectively became a McGovernite party for almost 20 years afterwards, even though he had lost by, you know, the public made it clear they didn't like what how he talked about foreign policy. They didn't like how he talked about crime. They didn't like how he talked about taxes. They didn't like his embrace of the new left, and they didn't like the basic anti-Americanism of the approach. And all this was muddied by Watergate after it. But, you know, assuming that there had been no Watergate, the Democrats would have been, you know, the Reagan takeover of the House and Senate and stuff like that would have happened way earlier.
But Watergate's a great lesson for Republicans, too. Nixon abdicated. Gerald Ford narrowly lost after a wipeout down ballot in the midterm elections of 74. And then in the next cycle, they come back to win the presidency.
Right. And more important, I think, that
with a different agenda.
Right, more important than all of this is this notion that populists who are nonetheless disgusted by Trump, or you know, they want to embrace the populism of Trump without Trump, like Ben Domenech and others, will not tell you what part of the Trump agenda it is that they think we need to hold on to. So let them say, I would like to know. Is a Muslim ban something that they like? You know, I mean, fine. So maybe the Republican Party will be talking about a wall for the next 50 years, whatever. Do they want trade wars? It's like, yes, well, you know, we haven't really looked at this. And in fact, yes, America makes bets. Okay, so do we want a trade war with China or not? Please, as Noah was pointing out, what is the lead policy agenda on the Trump website?
It, quote, unquote, trade war.
Yeah,
actually, that's the thing. It's right under the establishment.
Yeah, we have a major presidential candidate of one of the two parties in the United States 90 years after Smoot-Hawley, actually calling for a trade. Talk about the great forgetting. Like, you know, the world's worst economic period, you know, of the last 300 years took place as a result of a trade war started and inaugurated by the United States through legislation through Congress.
And this is my point, is that Republican reformers aren't going to be able to escape the notion that this agenda was rejected. And because it was so amorphous, we're not really able to identify what was rejected.
We're having a definitional problem here, because Republican reformers ordinarily refers to people like Paul Ryan and stuff like that, who it is the argument of the of this group of non-Trump but not anti-anti-Trump, anti-anti-anti-anti-Trump people like Ben Domenech or something like that. They're not really the reform Republicans as the term. The reform Republicans refers to people who have been, who made the, who, you know, very honestly and with good hearts, beginning in 2006, said, look, there's a whole bunch of people who are being left behind in our economy. We need to structure ways to speak to them. You know, that was Ross Douthat and Rehan Salem's book, Sam's Club Republicans, which emerged from an article in the Weekly Standard. We've published Yuval Levin on the mobility crisis and Paul Ryan's budgets and now his Better Way agenda. These are all efforts. These are all very conscious, very meaningful efforts to attempt to cope with the fact that there are people who have been left behind and that policies can be used to structure.
But it's just
to help
one
them.
Wing of the. We also have immigration reformers and others.
But it didn't work. It's been 10 years and it didn't work. I wish it worked. Look, I believe in it. I believe in many of the agenda items that are part. It didn't work as a as an electoral selling agenda. Effectively, both Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio ran as these reform Republicans.
Right. That really is the content of what people talk vaguely about as Trumpism. It would be helping people through these very unsexy policies.
Right. But that's the nonsense, because if you were to say, well, we need Trumpism without Trump, meaning figure out some way to speak to and reintegrate the white working class into the fabric of the United States as it appears to be disweaving itself from it, the only agenda that exists is the reform agenda, and that's Paul Ryan, and he's bad, and he's just going to be a blank check for Hillary Clinton.
And here's our definition problem: is if you were to say that Donald Trump represents a crasser version of Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio, everybody who sees amnesty behind every shadow is going to reject that definition wholeheartedly.
And of course,
that's another element of the Trump coalition that wants to preserve its agenda in amber and say that it was not completely defeated wholeheartedly by the whole electorate.
Anyway, so the whole point here is that it's not true. Trump is not their tribune. It is not a tribune. It would not work to be the tribune of the white working class to inaugurate a trade war with China, which would end up raising prices at every store in America by 25%, which is something that's really helpful to people who are living, you know, if they're even living paycheck to paycheck. It is not helpful. None of this is helpful. Trump is about something else. It is a cultural message about feeling left behind, about rage, about, you know, and about an honest feeling that the culture is galloping in a direction in which the country is being reshaped without input from a lot of its, from a lot of the self-governed Americans. You know, I mean, courts are doing things and bureaucrats are doing things, and Obama is deeding, you know, the Congress is deeding bills passed. Obama is, you know, playing games with executive orders that are unconstitutional. And there is no, and the pushback seems to them to be ineffectual. As Noah points out and as others point out, the notion that, you know, Republicans didn't fight back against Obama's unconstitutional, you know, efforts at expanding executive power is so insane as to beggar description. Obama lost on the National Labor Relations Board case where he attempted to appoint people without congressional approval, lost 9-0. The structure of the Elizabeth Warren created civilian, whatever you call that, the Consumer Credit Bureau has just been ruled unconstitutional by a court in D.C. The DREAM Act effort to declare people you know, to say that the IRS was no longer responsible for enforcing immigration legislation, was ruled unconstitutional by court after court after court. This is how you do it when people do it. Republicans or conservatives have been pursuing every avenue that is possible. We almost got Obamacare overturned in the Supreme Court, and it was only the sort of the doctrinal corruption of John Roberts that allowed it to stay afloat.
I was shocked, and in retrospect, it was actually a real canary in the coal mine when Republicans, the Republican-controlled Congress in January, passed the repeal of Obamacare, and it landed on Obama's desk, and he vetoed it, and nobody on the right talked about it or cared.
Yeah, but
with the exception of the left. The left was very attuned to that. They were furious and scared.
Yeah.
The right didn't care.
Yeah, not the right didn't care because the world of the right-wing media had decided that the line that was going to be proffered about 2016 was that nobody did anything to stop anything. This is what Mitch McConnell, who is, you know, everybody now hates Mitch McConnell. So these people hate Mitch McConnell for being a wuss, and the Never Trumpers hate Mitch McConnell for being a wuss, and everybody thinks Mitch McConnell is a wuss. And as Mitch and he may well be a wuss, but you know, it's not like there weren't 47. I think it was 47 different votes to repeal Obamacare after its passage in 2010. Both in the House and in the Senate, there were votes, 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 votes. What exactly is it that's supposed to be done? You know, that is the problem.
They also defunded Planned Parenthood.
Right, and that was vetoed. But that doesn't count. So nothing counts. It only counts.
Right.
This is a little like the conversation that Trump had with Hillary Clinton at the second debate, right? Where he said, he said something like, "Oh, you wanted to defund the banks, or you wanted to break up the banks. Why didn't you do it?" And she said, "Well, I was a Democratic senator, and there was a Republican president, and I was one of 100 senators, and so there's such a thing as a veto." And he's like, "Yeah, you were ineffective. You didn't do it." Okay, fine. So if this is now, by the way, that's fine. I don't really care because senators should have to answer questions like that, and maybe they could spend some time explaining how the government works, since no one has a civics lesson anymore and doesn't understand this that she sort of laid out with her in her arch ironic way. But that's the point, which is we're not winning, and it's our fault that we're not winning. That's the joke. It's like callers to a talk radio station about, you know, the New York Jets in New York City. So the Jets, it's not that the other teams win, it's that the Jets lose, and so the problem is the coach or the quarterback or the this or that or the other thing, right? So maybe that's true about sports. I stopped following sports a long time ago. But the idea that the focus is all interior, it's all internal. It's all internal. It's all about what you did, what you didn't do to win, and what you didn't do to win, whereas when you can't win, there was no winning. The president of the United States was a Democrat. We just saw one bill of Obama's in 8 years was just overturned by, you know, the veto was overturned, and it's a ridiculous piece of legislation that is just, you know, like showboaty and grandstandy, and he vetoed it for actually probably pretty good reasons, and they overturned it because they wanted to look better, you know, close to election.
I mean, the sports analogy is fun, but there's an element of this that really does need to be thoroughly and brutally repudiated by the electorate, which is an instinct that welcomes enlightened despotism. I mean, there's more of a desire to see action for action's sake than responsible legislation through a constitutional process. And that's not limited to the right. It's the left as well. It has been the left traditionally.
No, it's worse. Yeah. It's worse on the left.
And that's why. And now
Obama's
we have
Obama's who said, we can't wait. We can't wait. Because the process of the American people handed Obama a divided government. The American people decided on divided government, and Obama didn't like it. So he said, I have divided government, and I don't like it. So I'll do things that I'm not allowed to do, and then I'll dare the courts to...
I mean, action for action's sake is exactly the horror of what Trump brought to the right.
And that's why you can't divorce the man from message and message from man. They are both going to be repudiated and deserve it.
One hopes. But the fight will continue. I mean, that's part of the point here is if there is a Trumpism without Trump, the other thing is, who are the elected officials? Who are the elected officials who are going to be the tribunes of of Trumpism without Trump. Senator Jefferson Beauregard Davis Candyland Sessions. I mean, you know, everybody that we know who is like the Trump surrogate apologist, you know, Rudy Giuliani last ran for office in 1997, except for his brief abortive bid for the presidency in 2008. So Newt Gingrich last ran for office in 1998. Except for his abortive bid for the presidency in 2012. You know, Ben Carson never ran for office except for his abortive bid for the presidency. Chris Christie is the only one, and of course he's out of office, and doesn't look good for him, by the way, with some of the stuff that's going on in the Bridgegate trial. Who's his tribune? Who's going to carry his flag forward? Some congressman you never heard of, who will, you know, surely start, you know, issuing forth. You know, it's going to turn into that. There was this guy named Pete Stark, who was a Democratic congressman from San Diego. And every year he would initiate impeachment proceedings against whatever Republican was president, Fortney Pete Stark. Well, I mean, we'll have that. There'll be somebody like that. I mean, who's going to represent him? My old friend Dana Rohrabacher, who is Putin's representative in Congress, congressman from Long Beach, California. I mean, you know, the discrediting that is going on here of the supporters of Trump himself, it is not the case that people say, I will carry forward the banner of George McGovern or Walter Mondale or, you know, George H.W. Bush when they're humiliated at the polls. People don't want to be associated with losers. Isn't that what we learned from Trump?
Yes, well, we'll and even people like Christie and Newt, it's not like Trump was what they've been waiting for their whole lives anyway. It's not like they're very particularly interested in this message. You know,
well, who knows what they're interested in. I mean, you know, Giuliani's behavior over the last week has been so
reprehensible
and disgusting that, you know, I mean, talk about sort of like going out in, you know, by like flushing yourself down the toilet. It's pretty, you know, depressing. I'm somebody who wrote a book 10 years ago saying that the only way to defeat Hillary Clinton for the presidency in 2008 was for Rudy Giuliani to be the Republican nominee. So, by the way, which should give you some pause about listening to my prognostications between now and Election Day, but these are ballasted by actual, you know, numbers. So we come to an end of another hysterical blatherskite performance here at the Commentary Magazine podcast, Commentary, the 71-year-old monthly of, we hope, rather more calmer disposition, but equally as passionate in its argumentation and its polemic. Please join us at CommentaryMagazine.com. You get some free reads, and then we ask you to pay $19.99 for a digital subscription or $29.99 for a full-on subscription that gets you everything, including our monthly magazine. For Abe Greenwald and Noah Rothman, I'm John Podhoretz. We'll be back on Thursday to survey the wreckage of the third debate and keep the candle burning.